everyone. Welcome back to the Internet Report, where we uncover what's working and what's breaking on the internet, and why. This week, we're discussing the pros and cons of traffic management, and looking at issues some people experienced when attempting to purchase tickets for the upcoming Oasis concerts. We'll also chat about an AT&T issue that impacted Microsoft, as well as disruptions at Akamai, Alibaba, and Cloudflare. I'm Barry Collins, and I'll be hosting today with the amazing Mike Hicks, Principal Solutions Analyst at Cisco Thousand Eyes. As always, we've included chapters in the episode description below, so you can skip ahead to the sections that are most interesting to you. And if you haven't already, we'd love you to take a moment to give us a follow over at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen. Let's start with that rush to buy tickets for the Oasis concerts. Here's Mike to explain what he saw before the tickets even went on sale.
When you have these large ticketing events there, so and or events going on where people want to sort of log online to get these things, you know, such as the large product launch when something's actually going to be delivered, we start to sort of see these increases. Now, the reason we sort of saw this increase beforehand was because it's almost like a throwback to the old days where you'd actually go and queue up for your cup final tickets, where you sort of go outside and camp outside. So people think that even though they say the ticket sales in this case were going on at 8 a.m. UTC, that they'll actually be able to get in earlier. So they start to sort of log on and think they're getting a place in the queue as they're waiting for it to come online. So what this does is then it actually sort of generates this increased load. So we're starting to see the people as if they were going to transact on the tickets, but they can't do anything. They're effectively just queuing outside the door, as it were. But at that point, they're not necessarily in an official queue.
So the ticketing sites were under huge pressure before the tickets even went on sale. What happened when they did finally go on sale at 8 a.m. UTC?
It varied between the ticket agencies. So there was a couple of ticket agencies or three ticket agencies who were actually involved in the sale of the tickets. And we saw a similar pattern before everything started. So we saw an increase in response times. Now, again, kind of indicative of a load, but there's no latency on the network paths going into where these tests were running from. You could start to see an increase occurring as people were sitting in line and sort of hitting the queue. Now, when the tickets went on sale, then what we started to see was sort of differencing, varying on the different ticket agencies. All three of the agencies were using a sort of CDN to reduce the latency and to sort of almost act as that bypass, so we could actually prefetch things and bring it into the back end there so people could actually get online. But then it differed in terms of the processes we actually saw. For Ticketmaster, what you saw was effectively people starting to get in the queue. Now, they have some interesting things. They actually list this on their FAQ page, where once the actual sales come online, you're basically, they will randomly allocate you a place in the queue and actually start that process. You start doing this purchasing thing. And as then this load increased, the demand increased, where people are trying to hit these back-end services, what we then started to see was service unavailable and these intermittent drops. Now, again, we're not looking at the actual complete transaction. We weren't actually transacting on it. So we're looking for signals coming back from the environments to say, this is what was going on at that time, which is indicative of we're in that process and we're trying to get some information coming back.
So that's Ticketmaster. What about the other ticketing agencies?
And then what we saw from the other ticket agencies, again, using a CDN to that front door, and they were almost put people into a waiting room situation. So it wasn't necessarily a traditional waiting room where we're diverting people. But what you were doing, you're in this sort of holding pattern. And then what we saw from the traffic profiles is coming through there, again, looking at our system, as we started to see the wait and almost the buffering signal coming back from there. So we saw a change in the state of the page, which was being served out of the CDN to say, sorry, we're busy, pre-trial is going later. You know, these types of messages were sort of there, or you're in, you know, just we're holding at that point there. Then as that sort of progressed, as the time sort of progressed through, then what we started to see was some error messages coming back or some status codes, which were 429, which is indicative of some sort of rate limiting. So what we're saying is we just want to throttle that throughput as we go through there. So we're, you know, we're letting you through one door at a time. So again, the equivalent of opening up 1,000 turnstiles at once, letting one person through, and then, you know, we're all going to then go into the back end systems as we get there. And we saw sort of this intermittent throughout the process. And again, if I took a look at the other ticket agency, I saw these service unavailable and these system timeouts again through that process is just how they did that. And then it was almost to the minute after 3 hours. So understand from reports that the tickets sold out after 3 hours. Then services sort of returned before that. And it's not before open because obviously we saw that load increase beforehand, but before that time, they returned to normal levels.
As you said, some of the ticketing sites were using a waiting room to prevent overload on their servers. Just explain how these waiting rooms are supposed to work.
this is caught into a pint pot. You can't get so much traffic into it. So what you want to do is you want to sort of suppress it. So rate limit the people coming through. There's a couple of things we want to do there. So one, we want people to understand that they're in a queue. They're sort of waiting that they're there. So what happens is you hit the front door and then you get redirected to this waiting site, basically. And it starts to do the allocation of positions in the queue and things like that. The idea is we've actually sort of got them into the process at that moment in time, rather than just getting rejecting service unavailable. So if we're dealing with something that is a non-demand event, these were the ticket agencies who are actually selling it. To a degree, you have a monopoly essentially on that sort of sales process or that time. Now, if we're dealing with something such as like a Black Friday sale, where we have multiple systems available to do that, I don't want that customer to drop off and go somewhere else. So then what I do in terms of the waiting room is I'm actually sort of, maybe I'm shifting around, you know, like through a phone system, I'm redirecting to here. Then after a period of time, we might be putting up a different page, or we're redirecting them somewhere else, or we're making sure they go in that side. And we can estimate the numbers we wanted to get on there. And we're spreading it over a 24-hour period, so we can sort of scale accordingly. We can have our waiting rooms. If I'm dealing with something that's going to be this flood of information, or this flood of requests all at once, it's a little hard to sort of scale to be able to do that. I mean, obviously you can, but do I put that sort of infrastructure in place that's going to cost me a lot of money to do that is really sort of for that one-off instances? So then we sort of try and do it within software, but ultimately what's going to happen in those cases where you do get that deluge of requests, you're going to start to get these bottlenecks occurring within the system.
Managing a huge surge in incoming traffic is always difficult, even when you're expecting it. Tell us about why that is and share some strategies that companies can use to prepare for such situations.
Think about the different strategies we have, or the different events that are occurring, that they have different characteristics to them, just as the applications running on the network have different characteristics. Think about where our customers are coming from. So where our users are based. So these were ticket sales, for example, that were going on sale for concerts in the UK. That's not to say that the demand for tickets isn't going to be global, but it really meant that, you know, that's where my main load is going to be. So then I'll size up and do that accordingly from there, because my load from distributed environment from Australia or from the US is, you know, we're expecting to be less in that moment in time. But then, you know, again, what's the product I'm actually selling? This time there was three ticket agencies that had access to these tickets to be able to sort of sell them there. So then it's not that it doesn't matter what the performance is, because you still want to get those sort of shifted and go through that environment there. But you're not going to lose a customer, because they're going to keep trying and go back in the queue to actually do that. Now, whereas if I'm thinking about the Black Friday sales, I have multiple sellers want to do this, then I can need to size my architecture accordingly. Because I'm saying, right, for this moment in time, and remember, we're dealing with a lot of software these days, so it's easier to spin up instances for that moment in time. So I can actually do that and bear the cost, because I'm going to get that back in my sales. So these are types of things I need to consider. It is also, you know, where my customers are, what's the applications I'm actually looking at. How do I want to keep them into the process? So think about how my traffic management actually works. Do I just want to sort of schedule it, you coming through that turnstile, to use a sports analogy, or is it something that I want to get them involved in the process, because then I can, you know, maybe sell them other stuff while you're waiting? Do you want to buy some merchandise? All these things have to be considered in that ultimate digital experience.
What are some of the pros and cons of traffic management? Talk about the trade-offs that IT ops teams may have to make to maintain the best possible experience for as many users as possible during those high traffic periods.
So the biggest thing you have to think about here is essentially sort of your brand loyalty or your brand reputation. What are the things I need to consider? Are my users going to go somewhere else? My customers going to go somewhere else? And also, I said, what part of that process do I need to hook them into? Is it better to have a sort of slower experience and more controlled, slow and steady wins the race type of aspect? So I have them engaged, they might be frustrated. And this could almost include, you know, we're going through this. Do you want an obstructive view, a semi-obstructive view? Which seat do you want? What's in row? You know, you can almost sort of start to sort of tear it off in that way. But I've got them in the process at that moment in time. So what I'm dealing there with is my brand loyalty. So I need to engage them. If you think about how we do this, and Disney do this brilliantly for their theme park perspective, when I'm actually in the queues, there's different activities going on in that queue. When I'm actually waiting to go on a ride, before I get to the front, I realize I'm too small to ride that ride. But you go through that process. I'm constantly engaged as I go through that process. And again, these are things I need to think about. What is it I care about here? Ultimately, I care about my digital experience, sort of how my customers are going to be. But what's that going to be to me? Am I going to lose a customer? Are they going to come back to me again? What's the best experience I can actually provide them for? And this all goes into that process of sort of understanding it. You know, you're going to get frustrated if you get stalled halfway through. But if that's the only place I can buy, they're going to come back. It just means that I'm going to take a battering in terms of that brand reputation.
On September the 12th, ThousandEyes observed issues for AT&T customers attempting to access Microsoft services such as Microsoft 365. Here's Mike to explain what happened.
So around 11:40 a.m. UTC on September the 12th, what ThousandEyes started to see was this increase in loss rate coming from the Microsoft network. Then as we sort of wound that back, what we actually started to see that was everywhere there was this AT&T peer involved, we were actually seeing the loss. There was a couple of things here. So one, it was in the Microsoft network, but we're only seeing it very specifically to Microsoft services themselves. And when I say that, it was the Microsoft applications. Microsoft actually came out with a statement, said that some of their users were experiencing connection issues, and it was down to some sort of third-party ISP. They said there was a configuration issue that they'd reversed. They'd made a configuration change, they'd reversed configuration change, and they'd rolled that back, and then service was started to be restored. And again, we started to see this. We started to see the paths coming back through, and we saw the loss rate drop as it went across those networks themselves.
The only users affected seemed to be using AT&T's peer connection to Microsoft. Explain why companies such as AT&T maintain peer connections to major players such as Microsoft in the first place, and what this means for customers.
So we're talking about these peer connections. We're talking about sort of this direct relationship. It doesn't necessarily have to be within the sort of availability zone or within Microsoft's area, but this is this area where the ISP's connectivity or the ISP's equipment directly connects into to the Microsoft's in this case there. So what this says, it means that the traffic then automatically gets straight onto their backbone. So what we're doing by doing that is we're in effect guaranteeing the latency. We're able to provide some SLAs on top of that. And you could argue you're starting to sort of do some things around security, improving that. Basically, you're assuring this digital experience you're going to get because I'm effectively going from just this one network into the other. I'm providing this direct pipe coming into there. Now, AT&T obviously is not exclusive to them. And then we have some of the main people such as Megaport, for example, also have these peering relationships we can actually connect into. So we're trying to reduce the latency. We're trying to improve the things. And then that provider themselves can also then start to offer that as a premium service. So what we're doing to you is we're having this access into this environment. And then this would be a reason for you to actually go with this provider over that provider based on where my region is, based on how they're connecting. They're also going to use this, again, to sort of provide that even for their home users from a VPN perspective, so to try and guarantee this connectivity. Because I have this relationship, I'm no longer sending my traffic necessarily over the internet or randomly down for these different peers. I actually have this ability where I'm going to peer directly into one to the other.
Multiple internet providers in the UK experienced disruption on September the 5th in an incident that was linked to CDN provider Akamai. What happened with this one, Mike?
We started seeing this loss rate coming to the Akamai CDN. We could see it was across multiple providers, and then you could also start to see it impacting different services off the back there. So it was spread across numbers. Regional-wise, it was actually looked like it was just coming into the UK environment. When it came back, what we saw was there was a particular autonomous system. So the autonomous system 7473, we were seeing a loss rate whenever this occurred in the past. When you sort of break that down a bit further, what we saw that was actually Singtel, and we could actually see then this was when this was inserted in the path, the traffic effectively was coming up into, so we're talking about European-based traffic, was going up and being routed or being taken a path to come through this Singapore network. Obviously some nodes in Singapore. So then as that traffic sort of flowed back down into the Akamai environment there, because we had the path was maintained, we're just taking a diverse route. What we started to see then was this loss rate occurring, which could be the way the packets were actually tagged. It wasn't expecting to see traffic coming from that direction, or it wasn't expecting to see the load coming in from that direction. So it was actually sort of being discarded or generating these loss rate traffic. Then when we saw that removed from the path, then things sort of returned to normal.
And was the theory that this was just a misconfiguration error that sent the traffic in the wrong direction?
Yeah, absolutely. So we see these B2B route links, which are typically caused by configuration error, where a finger slip and somebody sort of then advertises a network and then it goes and sort of inserts itself into the path and it just sort of takes this diverse path around there. So that's, yeah, typically what we expect to see. There was no evidence that this is anything sort of malicious or a bad actor involved here.
Alibaba's cloud services were disrupted on September the 10th when a fire broke out in one of its data centers. The fire started when lithium batteries exploded. Mike picks up the story.
The issues occurring from a fire is typically caused from like thermal runaway, which means they get hot. So it's the excessive heat and it sort of led to a fire. Now, the reason I'm sort of stating that is because then how do you put that out? Normally, when we're talking about a data center, those sort of fires are put out with sort of inert gas or foam. But because we're dealing with a heat dissipation here to actually cause a fire, the foam or the inert gas isn't good enough. It can dampen the flames and that, but what it can't do is actually cool it down enough to sort of put the fire out. So you have to use water. So this data center was operated by Digital Realty, and they came out and stated there was no injuries. But although there was little structural damage to the building, what happened was because of this excessive heat, it actually impacted some of the hosted equipment. And because they had to use water to put the lithium fire out, the suppression systems themselves had actually sort of damaged some of the storage disks. To maintain the data integrity on those, it takes a little while to sort of dry those systems out. They're sort of careful way. They can't just drop it in a bowl of rice as you would your iPhone. So they have to sort of go through this process just to sort it out. Now, what they started to say as soon as the systems were going down was they recommended people shift their workloads. So again, we're talking about software here. So it's effectively easy for you to take your workload that was hosting Alibaba and sort of shift it around. Now, this restoration period is some sort of long tail. We don't know specifically what services. And if you remember, some of the stuff we talk about here is we might be using a particular service on there, might be using a particular function within there. So you have to understand those dependencies. And it might not just be a case of moving the workload. There might be something sort of downstream, you know, a switch or something within some sort of service within that data center, which is impacted by the heat, which we then have to sort of work and move around.
Cloudflare also experienced a recent performance incident, leading to reachability issues for some applications leveraging its CDN and network services. What happened on this one, Mike?
So again, it sort of manifested itself as a loss rate. So we started to see the loss rate occurring. We couldn't see the system. So this appears to have been some sort of configuration error. Cloudflare reported they saw an elevation of a 499 and 500 error rates on their system. Now, when we're talking about the error rates coming from Cloudflare, these are indicative of the backend systems unable to process. We've had to kill the client connection. We waited for a response. We haven't got it. So it kind of points to something within that configuration system itself. We know this wasn't with the backend applications because that could also be indicative that it's coming from the system itself. What's my backend applications using these CDNs? I can't retrieve the information, as we've talked about. But the fact we saw this across different applications themselves, so we saw it on Zoom, we saw it on HubSpot, or impacting them, then you can identify that, okay, this is something within that CDN infrastructure itself there. So there was actually rolled back. The incident lasted around sort of 2 hours and it was resolved around 6 a.m. UTC.
Finally, let's have a quick look at the global outage numbers. What have we seen over the past few weeks?
We've seen a downward trend. We started to see this sort of coming out of August there, and it's continued through into September to where we are now. So global outage decreased over the period of September the 2nd to the 15th. We saw a 9% drop in the first week and then a 2% decrease in the following week. This wasn't exactly reflected in the US. So the numbers were pretty much stable there, but we saw an initial increase of 13% of outages in that first week, and then we saw a slight decrease of 1% in the following week. And when we look at those numbers, we saw, again, if we're looking at that decrease in numbers from a total global outage perspective, then in comparison with this almost stable level when I'm looking at the US outages, what this then meant was that more than 50% of the network outages were US-centric or occurred in the United States during this period. Now, this is up from the previous period where we saw around 45% in the previous 2 weeks.
That's it for this episode. Please like and subscribe. We really appreciate it. And not only does this ensure you're in the know when a new episode's published, it also helps us to shape the show for you. You can follow us on X at @ThousandEyes or send questions and feedback to internetreport@thousandeyes.com. Until next time. Goodbye.